This is a lecture tape for February 17th, 1999. We're on Deuteronomy chapter 16 to 19, God's festivals and legal system. Moses is continuing on with his second sermon on worship. Once they're in the promised land, the unity of God and his people are to be kept through worship at a central sanctuary by observing three yearly festivals. Now, at that time, all males in Israel must make a personal appearance before the Lord, and they must do so with an offering to the Lord. They're warned not to come empty-handed. These holy days, from which we get the word holiday, would then give the men necessary rest and recreation while bringing them together, all tribes, in worship. Now, these celebrations would set Israel apart for spiritual, physical, and corporate renewal as they remembered God's goodness to them in the past as well as in the present. He begins with three festivals, and the first one is Passover, which is to remember God's saving deliverance. It was to take place during the month Abib, which is March or April on our calendar, and it was to last for a full week when they included the Feast of Unleavened Bread that was attached with Passover. Now, the feast was to remember God's deliverance of Israel from slavery in Egypt. And you remember back to our study of Exodus with the original Passover, the people of Israel, in obedience and faith, put the blood of the sacrificial lamb on their doorposts, and the death angel passed over their homes while visiting the homes of Egypt. During that Passover, they were to eat a lamb, and they were to do so in haste, dressed for travel with staff in hand, ready to flee. And of course, you remember the story that when all the firstborns of Egypt were killed by the death angel, Pharaoh and the people told Israel to leave immediately, and so they fled in haste during the evening. When they fled, they took with them their bread in the bread trough, and because it was still evening, the bread did not have time to rise. And so in festivals, they were to eat only the unleavened bread, sometimes called the bread of affliction, to remind them that they fled quickly and didn't allow their bread to rise, but also because it was a reminder of the hardships that they endured during their time of slavery. Now, when God first gave that Passover, as I said, they were to use a sacrificial lamb. Moses is saying, now, when you get into the promised land, if you don't have flocks, it will be okay for you to bring an animal from your herds. But, he says, it must include only unleavened bread. The original Passover was celebrated in everybody's homes. And in the wilderness, the first giving of the Passover was that they would celebrate it in their tents or their location. Now God is saying that this is a time when they will come together to the place He chooses, and it's only at that one central location that they can celebrate Passover. The second feast is called the Feast of Weeks. It's remembering God's abundant generosity. It's also called the Feast of Harvest, First Fruits, and then in the New Testament, the Greek word is Pentecost. It occurs 7 weeks or 50 days after Passover. And it's interesting because they feel that this is approximately the same length that it took Israel to flee from Egypt and arrive at Mount Sinai, where they received God's laws. This was between the start of the barley harvest and the close of the wheat harvest, and because it is during a harvest season, the festival was to last for only one day. The emphasis of this feast was on the produce of the land, drawing attention to God's goodness to his people. He not only brought them out of Egypt, but he had continued to care for and bless them ever since. Look at chapter 16, verse 10. Celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God by giving a freewill offering in proportion to the blessings the Lord your God has given you. You see that there was no amount required to bring before the Lord. It was just based on how he had blessed them that year. An important feature about this feast and the next one, the Feast of Tabernacles, is that these include the entire family and everyone within the community. They were a time of rejoicing, and everybody was to participate in the harvest. The family could not rejoice if there were still those within the nation of Israel who were unable to eat, and so everyone was included in thanksgiving of God's bountiful harvest. The third one was the Feast of Tabernacles, and that was to remember God's continued faithfulness. It's sometimes called Tabernacles, sometimes Booth or Ingathering, and this actually took place in the autumn after the final harvest of the summer fruits, which included olives and grapes. This was a time of great celebration. All the people came together. It would be very equivalent to our Thanksgiving. At that time, when they were actually in the fields harvesting, they were living in tents, or booths as they call them, and so it was an appropriate time then to remember their wilderness days when they actually lived in tents and were dependent upon God for everything. As in the Feast of Weeks, this time was a time of joy and it included the entire family. Verse 14 says, "You, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maid servants, the Levites, the aliens, the fatherless and the widows, anyone who lived in your towns." It seems strange to us now because the book jumps from the religious festivals now to the legal system. But what that really says is God is just as interested in the legal decisions as he is in worship. God knew that good leadership would be important to Israel because when they had good leaders, they would be turned towards God and they would be following his laws, whereas if they had bad or indifferent leaders, they would tend to fall away from God, even fall into apostasy, corruption, and immorality. And so the next two chapters then go into the four important leadership roles within Egypt, the judges, the kings, priests, and prophets. And each one of them would have a different and distinctive role within the community. So let's look at the judges. Now in the wilderness, the people were judged by judges, but it was according to their numbers, by thousands and hundreds. Once they're in Canaan, God says that they are to have judges in each town and city. God wanted them to have immediate access when there was a problem. It was people that would be selected by the individuals of the community, and their job would be to administrate justice. They would settle any controversies, make sure any injured party received restitution, and anyone that had been considered guilty, that his punishment would be carried out. The judge himself was a man to be above reproach. Look at verse 19 of chapter 16. "You must never twist justice or show partiality. Never accept a bribe, for bribes blind the eyes of the wise and corrupt the decisions of the godly. Let true justice prevail so that you may live and occupy the land that the Lord your God is giving to you." It's interesting because way back in antiquity, the same problems existed. As soon as anyone receives some power and authority, it can easily be misused. They are never to accept bribes because that tends to corrupt. Then, as if to emphasize that spiritual problems would also confront Israel's leader, he moves on to following the Canaanite gods. He said this is absolutely detestable and forbidden by Israel. The leaders will have to legislate not only moral manners, but also spiritual matters. They will have to deal with stubborn disobedience as well as secret idolatry. And Moses points out that any type of worship that the Canaanites use is totally unacceptable and detestable to God. He even mentions a problem that you may become before God and you may think you're worshiping him, but if you include any of the Canaanite practices, that will be unacceptable. He mentions bringing animals that are less than perfect. He also says that corruption comes with secret adultery, and he warns the judges to be aware of what's going on in their cities and communities, and if they think that something's going on, they need to check it out and remove any idols from the land of Israel. A judge is also supposed to know when a case arises that's too difficult for him, how to handle that. Look at 17 verse 8. "Suppose a case arises in a local court that is too hard for you to decide, for instance, whether someone is guilty of murder or only manslaughter, or a difficult lawsuit, or a case involving different kinds of assault. Take such cases to the place the Lord your God will choose, where the Levitical priests and the judge on duty will hear the case and decide what to do. The decision they make at that place the Lord chooses will always stand. You must do exactly what they say. After they have interpreted the law and reached a verdict, the sentence they impose must be fully executed. Do not modify it in any way." What is he saying? If you can't determine it in your local cities and towns, then you're to go to the central location, the place where God's sanctuary is, and bring it before the priests. What are they doing? They're doing just like they had done in the wilderness. When the local judges or the judges of a thousands or one hundreds couldn't settle it, they brought it before Moses, and Moses brought it before the Lord, and the decision was the Lord's. It's the same thing here. It's brought before this main sanctuary, and it goes before the priests, who has the Urim and Thummim, who essentially takes it before the Lord, who makes a decision on it. It would be like us saying they went to the Supreme Court. Now, once a decision had been made, look at verse 12 of chapter 17. Anyone arrogant enough to reject the verdict of the judge or the priest who represents the Lord your God must be put to death. Such evil must be purged from Israel. Then everyone who hears about it will be afraid to act so arrogantly. What's he saying? God has made a judgment and a ruling, and if it is not followed, then the death penalty is to come immediately as a warning to others who would go against the rulings that the God has made through the priests. The next group of leadership is the kings. Now, Israel was supposed to be a theocracy. And a theocracy is God is king. Israel is his people. There was not supposed to be any human king between God and his people. But God knew that there would come a point in Israel's history where they wanted to be like all the nations around them, meaning that they wanted to have a physical king, one that had skin on them, if you will. And so he permits this, but he sets down certain rules to prevent any abuse of power. First, Israel's king must be chosen by God and not by the people. God says, I will choose the man that will serve as your king. He also must not be a foreigner, but he must be an Israelite. Why is that important? Because a foreigner would bring in false gods and false idols. God says, I won't have anything to do with it. Only one from within my nation will be the king of Israel. Next, he must not acquire a great number of horses. Now, that doesn't seem like a very serious event, except when you realize that the Egyptians were known as great warriors because of their horses and chariots. The best horses were in Egypt. So if Israel started depending upon horses, they would tend to go down to Egypt to get them, and God would absolutely forbid his people from going back to Egypt. Also, they would tend to rely on the horses rather than God. God said that Israel was to fight on foot. That way they would know that God was the one winning the battles for them. Israel's kings also must not take many wives. Now, this is not primarily a moral issue, although we know that was never God's plan, but it was a common practice of entering into marriages with princesses of neighboring kingdoms in order to have political alliances. But God knew that once these foreign wives came in, they would also bring pagan worship and idols into the royal palaces, which would turn the hearts away from God. Israel's kings also must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold, but they were to rely on God alone. God knew that if his kings were allowed to acquire horses, foreign wives, political alliances, and monetary wealth, all these could very easily take the place of God, and he wanted no rivals. Chapter 17, verse 18 has some very important information for the kings. Let's read it together. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the priests who are the Levites. What is God saying? He's saying when a king takes office, he is to sit down with my laws and he is to copy them word by word, letter by letter, so that I know that he is familiar with my laws. Continuing on, it is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this laws and these decrees. The king must not only know what's in there, he must also understand it, obey it, and rule his kingdom by it. He's also not to turn from the right or to the left of the law. He is to follow everything according to how God has directed him through the law. Finally, the king must not think of himself better than his brothers or sisters. Why is this? It's so important it's mentioned twice in both verses 15 and 20. God says the motivation for a king of Israel is love. He is to love his fellow countrymen, he is to love his God, and it is to be known as a kingdom of love. We come to the priests in 18 verses 1 through 14. Now they weren't just to perform various rituals for national worship, but they would be more like Israel's pastors. The people were minded not to forget them, since they would be dependent upon their tithes and offerings in order to carry out their jobs. God says the priests were to devote themselves fully to what God had called them to do, which is the caring, the teaching, and the leading of the people in all spiritual responsibilities. He says, if you know my laws and you are teaching my laws to the people, then they will obey these laws and they will bring their tithes and offerings to the Lord, which would in turn take care of the priest's needs so that they continue to do what God has called them to do. He warns the people, too, that they are not to bring leftovers as the portion which the priest received, but in 18:3, that the parts that the priest may claim as their share is the best. It's from the oxen and the sheep. They are to have the shoulder, the cheek, and the stomach, and you must also give them the first share of the grain, the new wine, the olive oil, the wool at sharing time. Verse 5, for the Lord your God has chosen them and their descendants out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the Lord's name always. God says, I want you to give them the first, the very best, because you are giving to me when you are giving to the priests. And he says, they stand and minister. Now that's an interesting word because it pictures a loyal servant, one who is standing in the presence of his master, ready to carry out his commands. The Bible uses that word to describe prophets, priests, and angels. And he says all three of these people stand in the presence of the Lord, ready to carry out his will. Verse 6 goes on, if a Levite moves from one of your towns anywhere in Israel where he is living and comes in all earnestness to the place where the Lord has chosen, he may minister in the name of the Lord his God like all his fellow Levites who serve there in the presence of the Lord. He is to share equally in their benefits, even though he has received money for the sale of his family's possession. What's God saying here? He's saying, during these three festivals, every male is required to go to the main sanctuary. That includes the local Levites. They too must go there. And he says, if they come to the sanctuary and wish to serve, since the entire population of Israel is there, they need to be allowed to serve in the sanctuary. They may not be pushed aside in favor of just the local priests and Levites who are in the city that I have chosen and the areas around. And they are also to receive a portion, because if they don't receive part of the Lord's tithe, then they would not be able to participate in these festivals. Under this section with regard to priests, occultism is addressed. Now, Israel's neighbors all around them have a very prominent place in their religious life for magic and witchcraft. If they want to ask their gods anything, it's done through witches and wizards. And God says he absolutely forbids Israel from doing such things. He said, if they have a question, they're to come before the priest, the high priest, who has the Urim and Thummim, and they can inquire of God, and he will give them his answer. They are not to use sorcery and witchcraft as the pagan nations do. In fact, that's the very reason why God is judging Canaan and why Israel is to wipe them out. And as we learned last week, remove even their names from history and from memory. He concludes his leadership with prophets. He says he would choose a prophet for his people. And when he does, they're to listen to him, not to witches and wizards. The prophets would be chosen by God. They are not to be self-appointed. Look at 18, and then God says, I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command of him. The prophet's role was to teach Israel what God has said. God will put his words in the prophet's mouth, and the prophet will say it to the people clearly, and they are to listen and to obey it. Look at verse 19. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. So you see, the prophet's role is to communicate the message of God faithfully, but he's not held responsible for the people's refusal to obey. God says he himself will hold the people accountable for the words that the prophet has said. But on the other hand, if a prophet dares to speak in the Lord's name something that is not of the Lord, God will hold him accountable. Look at verse 20. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, is to be put to death. God will have no false prophets in his land speaking on his behalf. He also gives a test in there. We were given a test last week by Moses how to tell a true and a false prophet. A true prophet always gives God credit, directs them to the things of God, and draws people to God. He's adding here, and a prophet of God is also 100% correct because he's speaking the very words of God. So if any of those things are not true, then you know that he is a false prophet. Well, chapter 19 brings us to the application of three offenses: murder, theft, and the bearing of false witnesses. Moses once again goes to manslaughter. It's a very important issue that's going to come up in the land of Canaan. He reminds Israel that there's going to be a total of 9 cities of refuge. 3 cities are set up on the Transjordan side across the Jordan. 3 are to be set up immediately when Israel goes in and claims the territory. And then as they continue to grow and expand, an additional 3 cities are to be set up, totaling 9 cities of refuge. If a person murders unintentionally, or as we say, accidentally, he may flee to one of those cities and be saved, essentially, until a trial occurs. At that time, if it is considered manslaughter, he spends his life within that city of refuge. However, if it is determined that it was murder, the city of refuge cannot be used as a hiding place, and he's actually returned to the nearest relative of the one who was murdered so that their blood may be avenged. He also addresses theft, and in this case, it's theft of land because they're going into the promised land. Everybody will receive an allotment or an inheritance, and they're being warned not to move their neighbor's boundary if they decide they want a little more land than they've been given. Because he said that is not only stealing, which is breaking of the law, but it's also coveting your neighbor's land. And so they break the covenant in 2 ways. Now, with the mention of murder and theft, it will involve witnesses. And so once again, he reminds them that a person cannot be convicted of a crime on the witness of only one person. It requires 2 or 3 witnesses. Then, because their testimony is so important, he again goes into a false witness. Look at 18 of chapter 19. If the witness proves to be a liar, giving a false testimony against his brother, then do to him as he intended to do to his brother. You must purge the evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. What is he saying? He's saying, in order to convict a person of murder or of theft, you have to have a minimum of 2 witnesses. If we find that those witnesses corroborated and they came together on their story in order to accuse a person falsely, that person who was a false witness then will in turn receive the penalty of what they accused them of. This is the reason why the witness is the first one to cast a stone in the death penalty, because that way if an innocent person is put to death, that witness has literally committed murder because they were the one who cast the first stone. Well, what's Moses saying here? He's very concerned that once they enter the promised land and life becomes comfortable and routine, they will forget coming together as a nation and kind of try to do their own thing. So to prevent that, God requires that the celebration of these particular festivals need to be done in one central location at the certain time of the year, so that they won't lose sight of, first off, their God, the very reason for their existence. God is their creator, their provider, their sustainer. Secondly, he doesn't want them to lose their identity. They're God's chosen people. They're a treasured possession to him. And finally, he doesn't want them to forget their unity. When they're spread out, they may very well just want to be their own tribe. And he says, you are not 12 tribes. You are one nation under God. This was so important that God required them to travel great distances to the one place that he would choose. And did you notice? They did it during the busiest time of the year. They had to do it even during harvest. I think we today need to take Moses' words to heart. It's just as important for you and I to realize that we are not to neglect the coming together in corporate worship any more than Israel was. It's important for us to be with other believers, worshiping God and remembering his faithfulness to us in the past and in the present, and encouraging one another of his faithfulness to come in the future. I think also it's a reminder for us that we are not an independent church. Even though we choose to worship in this one building, in this one location, we too are a part of the larger body, the body of God. Let's pray. Father, we come before you as part of the body. We love you, and we know each one of us is to be accountable for our own lives, that we are to read and to study your word and obey it, just as Israel was to read and study your law and obey it. I pray that we would always be mindful that we too are chosen by you, and that the reason we exist is because of you. Help us also to be united as one body in Jesus Christ. We love you, Lord. Amen.